Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com and it is the 10th of February 2014 and this is episode number 176. And today I have an interview with Colin Falconer, the author of over 30 books and a veteran of traditional publishing, now exploring his options as a hybrid author. And he shares some passionate opinions of the industry, as well as how to write historical fiction. And I am a fan of Colin's writing, so it was really fantastic to talk to him. And I have a few fan moments, fangirly moments, as we chat. A little bit of an update. I gave in to delirium. I don't like to print the book until like I've got a draft that can be read all the way through, but I actually printed it because last show I shared that I'd kind of lost the plot a bit. And this is the interesting thing with, you know, kind of murder mystery type books, because you have to put in all kinds of twists and, you know, try and confuse the reader so they don't guess who it is. But because I also write thrillers, I have to take it up a notch. I don't want to have just a basic murder mystery. So I've taken it up quite a few notches. So it becomes more of a conspiracy. And I basically needed to print it out and go through it. So I'm sort of re-editing from the beginning and, you know, working out all the kinks and amping all the chapters and, you know, just making everything a bit more dangerous. I think I may be influenced by Game of Thrones, which I'm currently started to watch. I've just finished season one. I don't have a TV, but my husband and I download shows when we want to, you know, do mindless entertainment. And gosh, I'm loving Game of Thrones. It's you know, considering I really like kick-ass violence and yeah, it's pretty good stuff. So I'm finding that it's kind of leaking into my writing, not with dragons and stuff, but in terms of the fact that everyone needs to be in danger a lot. So yeah, I might blog about it at some point, you know, lessons learned from George R.R. Martin. Super stuff. Anyway, what else? Oh yes, I've had some other ideas. I do want to write more books this year. And one of the interesting things that people talk about is linking series. So actually, I've got an idea for a novella that will have Morgan Sierra from the Arcane series and Blake Daniel from this murder mystery series join forces to stop a terrorist attack in London, or with a twist. My brand of supernatural twist, of course. I'm quite excited about that. I know what it's going to be. But I'm not allowed to write that until I've finished this draft of Delirium, and then I'm going to rest it. I've decided that this is really important to my writing. Stephen King recommends it, but I think, you know, we often don't do it enough. So I will be resting Delirium, writing this novella, and also I've started the, I've been doing quite a bit of research for the next Arcane full-length book, which I think will have the title of Inquisition. Which I think gives some hint of what it might include. But yeah, particularly dark and scary, obviously. So what else? I've been doing quite a bit of speaking, which has been good. And I've been on a lot of podcasts recently. If you listen to, I don't know if I mentioned this, but I was on Entrepreneur on Fire, which is a particularly enthusiastic podcast in January, and that's been awesome. So, and that's got lots of entrepreneurs on, obviously. So I feel really happy about that because it's kind of being recognised outside the writing niche, which is fantastic. I was also, I am about to, if you get this show on the day it goes out, I will be on the self-publishing podcast on Thursday, the 13th of February. And if you're listening to this at any other point, you can obviously go back and look for the episode 13th of of February on the selfpublishingpodcast.com, talking about public speaking for authors, which is my last non-fiction book, and also foreign rights and your options for international expansion, since we are all global business people these days. And I had a really good chat with the boys, Johnny, Sean and Dave. And if you're not listening to SPP, I highly advise that you try it out. If you can cope with dodgy, naughty jokes and language, boys will be boys. But I find them really funny, so you can learn a lot too. So I will be on SPP Thursday, 13th of February. Okay, I do have a rather big announcement, is that I am part of The 12, which are a group of award-winning and best-selling authors, including several New York Times best-selling authors and USA Today authors. There are 10 American authors, and me and M.A. Comley, who are both British, living in Europe. So we all write across the boundaries of thriller, mystery, horror and crime, connected by a love of intriguing characters, fast-paced writing and edge of your seat tension. And we have a box set coming out called Deadly Dozen, and it will be 12 amazing thrillers for the very bargain price of 99 cents. In total, the books in the box set have a 653 five-star reviews on Amazon, which is amazing. And some of them have sort of over 150 five-star reviews, which is just phenomenal. And I will be doing a special offer on the blog, on thecreativepen.com, on the 24th of February, 2014. So watch out for that if you'd like to win prizes as well as get this amazing book. I'll also be announcing it on the site and in my newsletter, email newsletter. So definitely wait for the 24th to check that out. But there are also pre-orders on Amazon and iBookstore. And it will be available on all e-readers. You can also sign up for the list or check out the authors and the books involved at the12xii.com. So that's XII is obviously 12 in Latin. So the12xii.com, and we're on Facebook as well at The 12. And yeah, so I'm really excited about that. And I will obviously talk about the marketing, sort of the marketing reasons for doing a box set after we see what the results are. So with 12 of us all, you know, sort of promoting it, we're hoping that we can actually make quite a big dent on some bestseller lists. So yeah, I'll be really interested to share how that goes. But watch out for that 24th of February. Okay, so the podcast is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, but today I have a very special promotion which the author, Jack Dunnigan, arranged before Kobo took over the sponsorship. So I will introduce his book. Power, money and religion can be a deadly mix. Mark Recusanto, conference coordinator for a prominent religious mission society, stands next in line to become its director. But at a religious retreat in the secluded resort on a sunny Caribbean island, Mark uncovers secrets long hidden and abusive acts of power that soon turn to treachery and death. A tale of one man's exploitation of power and his desperate acts to hide the secrets that could destroy him and the organization he has built. Shadows at Moonrise Bay is a page-turning mystery you won't be able to put down. Available now on the Kindle at mybook.to/shadows, as well as Nook, Kobo and in paperback. You can also find out about Shadows at Moonrise Bay on Jack's website at jackdunnigan.com. And that's Jack, DUNIGAN.com. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Colin Falconer. Hi Colin.
Hi, Jenna.
It's lovely to have you on the show. So just as an introduction, Colin is the international best-selling author of over 40 books translated into 23 languages, described as similar to Ken Follett, books with romance and high adventure drawn from many periods of history. So very exciting, and I've read a couple of different of your books, Colin, and I'm so excited to talk to you. I'm having a fan moment. That's sweet, you know.
That's sweet. Nice. Thank you. Yeah.
No, we'll get on with it. We'll get over that. Okay, so could you just, you know, give us a little bit more about you and, I guess, your writing background? You didn't suddenly manifest 40 books out of the air.
No, look, I started off, I've been writing really most of my working life now. I started off in advertising as a copywriter. When I first started writing, I was slaving away at a typewriter one day at a manuscript that didn't get published, as everyone will, I think, relate. And a mate of mine came around. He said, "I'm starting an advertising agency and I need a copywriter." And I said, "Well, John," I said, I feel a bit bad about, you know, I have no experience. I feel bad about taking your money off you." And he looked at me like, he said, "I can't pay you. I just need a copywriter." He said, "You can write there while you're in the office, and if we get any work, you know, we'll see what happens." And that's really how I started off. I started off writing scripts while I was slaving away at my manuscripts in his office. That's how I started. In over about 18 months, I started to collect quite a bit of freelance work and advertising work on the side, but it's not what I wanted to do. I ended up going to Sydney. I started working. It was one of those things I'd go to. In those days, you could go to TV companies and they'd say, "Can you write scripts?" And you'd go, "Well, yes, I can. Never written one before." And they'd give me a script and I'd go away and write it. And they said, "Yeah, that's okay. We'll give you some more." I mean, I just sit there and a lot of the time was just this poker face, like, "I can't believe this is happening," you know. I wrote a lot of, was doing a lot of feature magazine work, and one of my magazine articles was turned into a book, a non-fiction book. That helped me get an agent. And then with an agent, I was slaving away for 5 years with my first novel. And when the novel was published, I pretty much managed to stay in print pretty much ever since, with a really big hiccup about 6 or 7 years ago when, we go into that if you want, but that's when I didn't write for about 5 years.
So really, guess it was a bit of fake it till you make it at the beginning, but has writing a novel got easier over 40 books? Because, you know, I just wonder about that, because I'm struggling with like number 5.
Look, yes, it has, but only, I would only say that I finally thought, "Yeah, I think I know what I'm doing here," about 3 years ago. And that's, so it was faking it till you make it for almost all my writing life. I just thought, it was just, but about 3 years ago, I thought, "Yeah, I've got this. I think I know what I'm doing, finally." That's a long time to be feeling like, yeah, feeling that uncertain and that insecure. Mm.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that, because that makes everyone feel a lot better.
So it's funny, you know, like I'm on writers' groups and there's a lot of writers, you know, who's just starting out, and they all had that same thing, and I go, "Yeah, well, what's new, you know?" "Yeah, everybody feels that way." It's a very insecure process. I think it's because you learn so much. You can only learn so much from books and classes, and then you have to go and do it, and everybody, I think, finally comes to their own way. And for me anyway, it took an awful long while before I actually finally felt that I was actually good at what I was doing. And I'd been earning a living from it for about 25 years at that stage.
That's awesome. So just to get into a bit more detail. So for example, then, one of your more recent books, Isabella, Braveheart of France, which is your latest one. So what was your writing process for that? And how did you turn dry factual things into a story?
Well, it's... I'd just really written a little piece about her on my blog. I think I thought it was that her story would have been interesting for a couple of the history blogs that I was writing for. And then I looked at the story, and it's funny because people ask often where you get your ideas from, but ideas are everywhere. I don't think ideas are that hard for anyone, really. But which ideas to discard, and when you've got an idea, how to execute it, that's the hard thing. And this one, I saw a story in it. I saw, I did see a beginning, a middle, and an end. It wasn't the story of all of Isabella's life. It was just that particular period. It interested me, of course, because I'm a POM, you know. I was from England originally. And no one ever mentioned Isabella to me at school. They mentioned William the Conqueror invading England. They didn't mention Isabella or William of Orange, who both invaded England. And so that really captivated. I thought, oh, I've got to find out more about this. But then I saw the story in there. I didn't want to just, fictionalize history. I wanted a story, and I saw something very interesting there. I mean, I thought it had contemporary relevance. I had a good friend who's a counsellor and was complaining about how many men coming to see her who are actually, I think the word in America is on the downline. They're married, but they're gay. And this was Isabella's predicament. She was married to this guy, didn't even want to be, or maybe she liked him at first, but it was their arranged marriage. But he was gay. And so she's in this really very contemporary predicament in the 13th century. And I just thought this was wonderful, wonderful conflict. And so then I looked more into the story and came up with a rounded novel out of it. Mm.
That's fantastic. Because I guess one question people have around historical fiction is how much of it is true, has to be true, and how much of it is kind of made up.
Mm. It's really I find it that question coming up in almost all reviews, all go to writers' festivals, all panels. It comes up all the time. It intrigues me a bit. Like, I don't actually mess with history. I speculate on history. I really look at, well, this is what happened, so why did it happen? And it frustrates me a little because I'm not really that much interested in history. I'm not an historian. I'm interested in stories and in people. But when I come to research a book, whether it would be a modern-day crime thriller or an historical, I want my facts. I want my facts straight. I recently had a review on one of my other books, Cleopatra, and the writer took me to task for not knowing my history. Now, I would let London to a brick that person didn't read 67 novels about Cleopatra and ancient Egypt, as I did to do that. History is not cast in stone, you know. It depends on your point of view. I mean, one of the problems I had, for example, in doing Cleopatra is the historians wouldn't agree with each other, so I had to choose one. Who thought what happened, you know, like at a Battle of Actium and stuff like this. And this question intrigues me. I suppose if you mess with history, you should make acknowledgements at the back. But I think it's perfectly okay to speculate about history as long as you're not bending any facts. And that's why it's sometimes difficult. I mean, for example, Isabella featured in Braveheart, the Braveheart, the movie, where she had an affair with Mel Gibson. Now, in real life, she was 9 years old at the time. Now, movies can get away with that. Plus, he was wearing a kilt. Now, I know Mel Gibson looked good in a kilt, but they didn't have kilts at that period. So, obviously, you know, they were playing to the crowd, or the you know, one half of the crowd. But, I mean, but movies get away with this and become huge box office success, but a novelist steps out of line once and everybody's going, oh, no, that book's no good. I won't read it because it's not historically correct. I just think, get out of here. It just irritates me. I do my absolute, I research really hard to get all my facts straight, but I won't say that I will agree with everyone because history is not cast in stone, and that's my sort of... I think myself, I know a lot of, I've read Bernard Cornwell was saying the same thing about this. He said, you know, look, we're writing stories, we're not writing history.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And you talk there about point of view. And of course, you've got the Jerusalem series, which I love. I've been to Israel a lot. You know, my husband's Jewish. I'm all my books have Israel in and, you know, all kinds of religious stuff. And I wondered how you walk the line there with religion. I mean, there's history is one thing. Religion is a whole nother thing. Now, I also struggle with this kind of walking the line between, you know, point of view, basically. How do you manage that?
Well, in Jerusalem, it's interesting. Again, I got reviews from people complaining I was pro-Arab and others complaining I was pro-Jewish.
Yeah.
What I tried to do was give both points of view, because that was the really interesting thing for me, because it seems like whenever there's anything in the news, we're trained on the news to believe there is only one point of view. This is why I believe the reporting on Syria has been so sparse, because no one can decide who's the good guy and the bad guy, because actually there isn't one. And with the story like Jerusalem, I was telling it from the point of view of the Arabs who'd been in Palestine all their life, from the Jews who'd come from Germany escaping the Holocaust, the Jews who'd been there before, the Zionists who'd been sold this, but the rich Arabs had sold them this land, which is something I didn't know. The rich Arabs sold them this land, thinking it was a huge joke that they put one over on the Jews because this land was. But of course, the Jews came there with all the modern farming techniques and actually turned these deserts into productive arable land. So there's all these different points of view, and that to me is more intriguing than taking a hard line on religion. Myself, I'm not religious in any way. I've written in my last two books, Silk Road and Stick Martyr, I can come down quite hard on the medieval church. So I don't have a position to come from, so I don't feel conflicted about it. I look at it from the point of view of the people that the religion affects and how it affects them, and that to me is where the story lies. So I don't struggle with that too much.
That's great to hear, and it's your series and also James Michener's The Source. They're kind of mod. I would love to write a kind of epic like that one day. So it's one of my aims to do that. But I also wanted to ask you about.
It's funny if I can just interrupt you there. So when I did write it originally, it was came out as with Hodders in the UK as the original was a paperback. And I wrote this epic, and my editor rang me up, and he said, look, he said, I've got your manuscript. I said, you're good. He said, it's 1,100 pages long. I said, yeah, it's great, isn't it? He said, no, it's not. He said, this is way too long for us. You've got to take 200 pages out. I said, well, I can't take 200. It's all perfect, you know, as you know, precious writers do. This is all perfect as it is. He said, well, I'm sorry. He said, you've got to get down to 900 pages. Got it down to 901. I left the extra page in just to you know, stir him up a bit. It's a great lesson in editing. But so sagas are good, but you have to know, I think, how much saga your publisher is willing to take.
Oh, well, you know, we'll come back to self-publishing in a minute. But I also wanted to ask you about romance, because I think men writing romance is fantastic. But there's people like... oh God, what's his name? You know, when they say it's a love story, it's not romance. You know, when men write romance, it's called a love story, and when women write, it's called a romance. What do you think about this whole gender issue with romance? Is there one at all, or is it just a fake?
Oh, it's. I never realised, I think, for a long time that I always had love stories in there. I was picked up on it, and my niece actually, who reads a lot of my stuff, says, "How come there's always love stories?" I think, for me anyway, I think we learn more through who we love and how we love them, and maybe how we lose them, than anything else. So I don't see how you can avoid it in stories. I mean, for me, it's not... I'm a guy. I don't think I write Nicholas Sparks or Mills and Boone or anything like that, but there is always a love story in there. I'm told that I write strong females. I've had a lot of strong I've known a lot of strong women in my life, so I don't, they're never just decoration. I mean, they're always there, and they've got characters, and they've got their own goals and agendas. So I don't, I've never thought about it that much. I've never thought, oh, I'm writing romance, until the ebook revolution came around, and my publishers all said, oh, this is a good thing, because this is marketable. But I never thought about it before then. It was just, well, this is part of the story. Yeah.
Yeah.
And suddenly it became, yeah, right, man writing a bit of romance became a plus.
No, that's fantastic. And then I also wanted to ask you about travel, because I came to your books originally through The Year We Seize the Day, which is a non-fiction book on the Camino de Santiago. And you've travelled, yeah, a lot in your life. You've done a lot of travelling. So I wonder, you know, and for me, part of why I do this is to travel, to do research. That's kind of the thing.
Yeah.
So how has your travels kind of wound themselves into your writing?
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, sometimes I would try and think of a book because I wanted to go somewhere.
Yeah, I do that.
You know, Silk Road was one of those books. I thought, oh, I really want to go along the Silk Road. And it came out of that. And as it turned out, I mean, that's how it came about. There are places that I would go and or want to go, and I would think, oh, I wonder if I can get a book around that, so then I'll have an excuse to go there and be able to write it off. I do love traveling, and it's the best for me, it's the best part of the research. Mm. that's the to experience a place, to smell it. Jerusalem was interesting because the first time I'd done most of the book when I landed in Jerusalem and all the research, and I remember getting off the bus with these two other travellers, and they go, where should we go? And I go, well, I know this place. We go down here, we turn first on the left, second on the right, there's the hotel we're looking at. But after being there, I never realised how hilly it was. And so these are the things that I think you need to go to places for. I just love the travelling part of books. And Year We Seize the Day was something Ellie and I wrote because we wanted to do the Camino and thought there'd be a book in it. We never imagined in a million years the kind of book that it would be. That was shocked us both. But that's why we did it.
Yeah, well, it's one of my goals, and I have the Camino as part of one of my novels, but I want to go walk it as well. So I read all the books at that point, and yours was one of them, and I definitely urge people to go and read it to get a very different view of your writing life, I guess. But we're not going to go into it here.
Okay.
I then wanted to ask about, you know, to sort of switch into the publishing side. You got into publishing in the 80s, and of course the industry is so different now. And you're now with Cool Gus, which is Bob Mayer's imprint, and you know, Bob is like a hero to the indies out there. So I wondered if you could talk a bit about how the industry has changed and what you're seeing for what writers should be doing these days.
Well, look, I've remained what they call a hybrid author. I still have print contracts, and really in the hope that the publishers will catch up. Not necessarily in the expectation of it. I do get a bit depressed looking at how slow the publishing industry has been to embrace the changes. I've had nothing but a great time with working with Bob and Jen at Cool Gus. I mean, this has been an absolute revelation. And books that have failed miserably as print books have succeeded spectacularly as ebooks. And you have to ask yourself, you go, well, why was this? Why could they not, Silk Road, for example, was knocked back by all the big six in New York, said won't work. Well, it has worked. It's worked as an ebook very, very well, and it's got highly reviewed. And you think, well, something's going wrong somewhere. Something's wrong in the process. So I don't want to be here knocking the print industry because I'm still a part of it, but I don't know if publishers really realise how much anger there is in the among authors towards them, how much anger and frustration. I've been treated really shabbily by one publisher who's just... I really wouldn't know where to start in describing what they've done to me. I mean, it's just ridiculous. To the point that they had to change my name for the third book in the contract because the first two had stuffed up so spectacularly. Two books that have done really well in the interim as e-books. And, you know, as your authors, you tend to blame yourself. But then when you look at what's happening, what you can do yourself on e-books, you go, no, it wasn't my fault. It wasn't my fault. They really did stuff it up. I think the old idea of finishing a book, having it published 18 months later, sometimes published very badly, having no control over marketing, having no control over the covers, these are outdated ways of doing things. BookScan is scandalous because BookScan dictates how many books a bookstore is going to get. If you put one book into it, the book scan will tell the bookseller how many they sold, so they'll say, well, this next one will only take so many, regardless of how good that book is or how good or bad that book is. And then the print, brick-and-mortar bookstores look around and can't understand why they're going out of business. Well, it's not because of the e-book revolution. It's because of bad business practices. That's my thought. I love... it has been a completely new revolution for me. I mean, I came through the print industry with things were done a certain way, but I love the ebook industry. I love it. It's taken down the barriers between me and readers. It's given writers who perhaps would not have seen the light of day a chance to shine. I've embraced it wholeheartedly. I love it.
Mm. So you really see the change with self-publishing and ebooks and things as a very positive change?
Well, I do. I think I know it's revitalised my reading habits. I'm not just a writer, I'm a reader, of course. I mean, I look at these things both ways. As a reader, I just love it. I just love it. I mean, I can get books. I'm sick to death of buying $25 books that are crap. You know, if I buy a $5 book that's rubbish, well, okay. But also could find a really good $5 book. Well, then I'll go out and I'll buy probably the print book next time. But I'm sick of that. And I'm sick as a reader of not being able to get books or going into bookstores and looking around and seeing the same old stuff pushed to the front. I'd rather find my books another way. Plus, I'm into instant gratification, Joan. So I can press a button, I can get what I want right there and then. So yeah. It suits me as a reader. Now I'm talking as a reader right now, and I think the other great thing about the ebook revolution is it's given readers a greater voice. Sometimes when you look at some Amazon reviews, you think, well, maybe that's not a good thing. There's some crazy reviews out there, but. Generally speaking, I mean, I can get people write to me now. They can write to me on my blog. They can communicate with me after they've finished a book, got a link. I can communicate directly with my readers, find out what they like, what they don't like. And I do read the Amazon reviews because I get an idea of what people are looking for, what they're not looking for. It's a much more symbiotic relationship. I love it.
No, that's brilliant. And I'm interested because you've talked a bit, you mentioned history blogs earlier in the process and you talked there about your own blog. What do you think works in terms of marketing, or do you think you're at a place where you have such a big backlist that you don't really need to do any marketing?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer to that yet. I don't know whether the blog is going to help me in marketing. I think Cool Gus have done a very good job in marketing me just using my backlist. But I'm still fascinated with blogs and perhaps what they can do. It hasn't worked for me as far as marketing so far, but it has given me a lot of contacts with, you know, people who read my books, and I love that, so I've kept the blog. Whether it will be a marketing tool or not, I really don't know. I've just kept my options open on it. But I mean, I have gone to, you just don't know what's going to happen. I mean, in the future, maybe there won't, you know, we don't, none of us know now what's going to happen in the future. Maybe there won't be an Amazon or a Kobo, and we know, you know, maybe one day we'll have to sell us. I've gone to the point, you know, I have my own own website now. I've bought my own site and own it all. And for a writer, I don't know whether it's too much or it's not. One day it's going to be right. But we're still going through the revolution. I mean, the revolution isn't far from finished yet. You know, they're still chopping off heads down in the square. You know.
I totally agree. And I said this, I met up with an editor the other day and I said to her, you know, we really are, we're toddling in this. You know, the Kindle, when I lived in Australia, it was when the Kindle came out. It was less than 5 years ago the Kindle arrived in Australia. And actually just on Australia, because of course you're there now and I used to live there, and I became a total fan of ebooks because of the price of print in Australia is utterly ridiculous. So what do you see happening in the Australian market right now? Is Kindle winning, or iPad, or what's happening with the Australian industry?
Look, I haven't, because I've been away a year, I've only just got back, it's hard to gauge. Before I left, it seemed that no one had really quite, they sort of thought of the Kindle and ebooks as that American thing. But it seems Australia is sort of, with anything that happens, Australia just takes a little while to catch up on these things. It still seems to me that a lot of people have their head in the sand around ebooks. It is been a bit slow to catch up, but there's certainly some. I know there's a lot of interesting authors coming out of Australia. I know that. I read this great book recently by a girl called Favelle Parrott. And then, of course, R.L. Stedman's, another Australian. There's a few good authors coming out here and who are looking and gaining ground in the ebook market. Mm. Yeah.
And what about your books? Because I mean, because of course you write a lot of the historical stuff, and you've done countries kind of all over the world. Do you find that the series that you write about a country sell better in that country? Like, have you seen any kind of demographics around the topics of the book and where they sell?
Yes. Look, I've really always done well in Eastern Europe. Ridiculously so. I mean. It's kind of weird, actually, when I go to these small East European countries, it's almost like being a rock star in some of them, and then you come back here and I'm just me again, you know. But it's kind of weird. They have really done, I think, because of books like Harem, which was about Solomon the Magnificent, but that sold fantastically all around Eastern Europe. And because I've written a bit about Eastern Europe, I found a real, that's really always been a good, and it's kind of surreal, really, you know, it's really kind of surreal when you go to, I was invited to the Serbian Book Festival at the end of last year. And as I was coming out, leaving to get on the plane, the security guard came up to me and she said, "You're Colin Falconer." I said, "Yes, I am. Step aside, please." I mean, she had the gun, the whole thing, you know, and big. Oh, I thought, oh God, my, you know, they found out about the drugs in my youth. Anyway, it took me to one side, and she said, "Can you sign my book for me?" I said, "What book?" She said, "You've just been at the festival, Anastasia." She said, "Stay there." She held up the plane while she ran back to the team to get a copy, and I signed the book. Got on the plane, landed in Heathrow, you know, and it was back to be, get over there, you know, going up there. It is kind of surreal when those things happen. And I know it's true for a lot of writers. You just suddenly, for some reason, find a little, some book just really sparks. But like Harem, for instance, was fantastic in Germany, just sold 180,000 or something in its first couple of years there. Didn't do anything in the UK, didn't do anything in Australia. Didn't move in America when it came out in print. So it is very strange. Some countries, you write about something, Aztec went berserk in Mexico, but I had no idea about it till I got there. So, yeah, it's kind of strange.
And it's brilliant you say that, because I'm on this massive kind of trip at the moment telling people to think about, you know, you can't just think it's about the US and the UK. It's about the rest of the world, you know, and exactly what you're saying. And Germany right now, just in the news yesterday, the top 10 books in Germany, ebooks, are all self-published. So it's totally the right time to get into these other markets. So yeah, and you never know what's going to happen. So it's so good to hear that. So just a final question. So you've got you know, all these years of experience and you've shared so much, but for those of us who are looking to have this kind of long-term writing career, is there anything specific that you've learnt that will help us for the long term?
I think I would not, if I was starting off again, I would have I wouldn't have diversified as much as I have. I don't know, I think I was on some sort of trip of trying to prove something, you know, look, I can do this. Bad move. I should have stuck to one genre. I know that I would have been, if you look at the really, really top authors, there's not very many of them who've diversified. Being a one-trick pony is really not a bad choice. That was a bad choice for me, which I'm still learning. On stuff. I mean, one of the things about the ebook revolution is teaching us about author branding, things that Ernest Hemingway understood years ago, but we ignored that part of his talents. That would be certainly one thing. I think being a bit more cautious about rights, I got back to rights to most of my books, and really, publishers may seem like your friend when they come along to make you an offer, but they're not necessarily. I would be very cautious in these days. I've done much better with some of my books going through Cool Gus and going through ebooks than I have as print. And it's something, I'm sure you've been saying this. You've got to, these days, it's worth taking a really good look at it instead of being seduced by the, you know, there was a way of doing things. I'm not trying to knock publishers or all publishers, but these days you have to have a really hard look. I mean, it was Hugh Howey, I think, who sold his print rights but wouldn't sell his ebook rights. These days it's worth thinking about a lot of things. When you actually sign on the dotted line, think about what you're selling. Because publishers, I mean, my publisher just last year offered me on a book a ridiculously small amount of money for world rights. Now, yeah, I'll never get those rights back, and they want world rights for a stupid amount of money. And I think this is insulting, you know. So I went away and did something much better myself with it. So I think that would be the other thing I would be looking at. I think there's a lot of good information out on the net, like on your site, Jonah. There's really good information, and I think there's a lot that you can learn that it wasn't possible to learn when I was starting out.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Colin. So tell people where they can find you and your books online.
Well, look, if they go, it's colinfalconer.org. So that's where I am now. I just switched over a few days ago. That's got all of my books are there. There's links to all of my books and what they are and bits about me. On my blog, I have quite a bit of fun on my blog too. There's stuff there I think people just maybe hopefully enjoy reading. So that's all there.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for your time, Colin.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.